psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. So great to have you with us on this Saturday. Thanks for taking Faith Radio along with you. Got a great program lined up for you. Going to be talking to two guests from the ministry Focus on the Family, where I used to work for several years. The first half of the hour, we're going to be talking to Katie Overstreet, who is involved with a wonderful ministry to orphans and kids in foster care. And if you have a burden for those children, and of course all of us should, you will love what Katie has to say and hear what Focus is doing in this very vital area of ministry. And you'll learn, even if you've never considered adoption or taken into foster care, you'll learn what you could do to help out other parents who've made that decision, perhaps even in your own church. Katie has some great advice for us. And in the second half of the hour, we're going to be focusing on marriage with Jared Pingleton. Jared is the director of the counseling department at Focus on the Family and has a brand new book out on marriage, which I believe will help you if you're having any struggles right now, or maybe you know somebody who is. In fact, if you know a couple or an individual who's in a marriage and saying, man, I'm just ready to bail on this relationship, encourage them to tune in after 11:30 this morning, because we have some great information on how they might be able to get their marriage back on track with Dr. Jared Pingleton. Each week we look at some of the research in the news involving families, kids, teenagers, child development, Christianity, and culture. And I found something which I thought was really fascinating this week. I don't know if you heard about this. It has to do with Facebook and emotions. Here's a question for you. Could your Facebook friends have control over your emotions? Well, yeah, just possibly. New research is out from the University of California, and it found that feelings shared on Facebook through negative or positive posts or status updates are contagious. Yes, I said contagious. This study analyzed whether happiness and other emotions are actually spread from person to person on social networks such as Facebook. The researchers used data from more than 1 billion anonymous status updates, and they found that positive posts lead to more positive posts, while negative posts are a definite downer and lead to negative posts. In fact, according to the study, positive Facebook posts influence our behavior a lot more than the negative ones. It kind of spreads the love around. Now, this is what's really fascinating. They found that rainy days can change the mood of Facebook posts. And that mood change can be contagious. So if your friend posts about the rain in her city, you can begin to feel sad, even if it's sunny in your city. When a person directly affected by rainfall posts about it on Facebook, that one rainy day friend can negatively impact up to two other people in other parts of the country where it's not raining. Just amazing. You know, oh man, it's just such a gray day and the rain's falling. And so there's your friend in Phoenix. Oh man, I feel so bad for Susie. Oh. Researcher James Fowler at UC San Diego says it's possible that emotional contagion online is even stronger than we were able to measure. And they're thinking that possibly it could be used in some kind of community mental health treatment, because social networking is so pervasive now and so influential in our culture. Well, I was in a good mood when I started working on this report, but then I saw a status update from my friend in Seattle, and, well, now I'm feeling somewhat melancholy. not really. Hey, here's something else I found. Could certain factors in today's youth culture be causing our teenagers to be more depressed? It turns out that too much time wrapped up in media, too little activity, and not enough sleep could be leading to an increase in teen depression. New study came out. Researchers surveyed more than 12,000 students between the ages of 14 and 60, and they asked them about 8 potential risk factors for depression, things that we know can lead to depression, such as, I'll tell you the factors they asked them about, excessive drinking, using drugs, smoking heavily, truancy, high media use, lack of sleep, lack of exercise, and weight issues. Now, those last ones, we did not actually know that they might lead to depression. We knew that drinking, drugs, smoking, truancy, were, and weight issues, either eating too much or not eating enough, could lead to depression. But this thing about media use, lack of sleep, and lack of exercise surprised them. About 13% of the teens that they talked to were high in every possible category. And of those kids, about 1 out of 7 reported signs of depression. But they also found that about a third of the teens who had high scores in media use, lack of sleep, and lack of exercise were almost as prone to be depressed as the kids who engaged in those more risky behaviors, the drinking, drugs, truancy, et cetera, et cetera. So simply being obsessed with, mobile technology or social networking, being on the computer all day or watching some kind of, TV or movies all day and not getting enough sleep and not getting enough exercise can lead kids to be depressed. Isn't that disturbing? Meanwhile, another study is out from the researchers at Kent State University, and they found that college students who use their smartphones frequently are more likely to suffer higher anxiety, have lower grade point averages, and be less happy than their peers who are not as tethered to tech as they are. As I read these stories, I'm just seeing more and more solid evidence that mobile technology and social networking, too much time spent in front of a screen, is simply not good for us. It's not good for us physically, emotionally, relationally, and I would add spiritually. Not that these things are bad in and of themselves, but it's the time and it's the obsessive nature of this. I mean, I have a friend who, it seems like whenever I'm with her, she'll set her phone down on the, let's say, a table, and the little status updates and tweet notifications and text notifications, I swear, her phone, every 30 seconds, one of these things is vibrating because she puts it in silent mode, but I can feel it vibrating on the table. Bzz, 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 bzz. How can you not, if you are so locked in, so tied to your mobile device, and then, of course, all the research on how people, the comparison game with social networking, and, my friend's life is perfect, and their kids are just adorable, and they have no problems, and look at my family, it's second best, and then that leads to, more depression and lack of self-esteem, and on and on and on. So I don't know, folks. Starting to see a lot of stuff here that troubles me. If you want to read an excellent book on this, it's actually a pretty troubling book, too. You might want to pick up The Digital Invasion by Dr. Archibald Hart, a psychologist who I'm very familiar with, written this great book, The Digital Invasion, wrote it with his daughter, who's also a therapist. You might want to pick that up. And if you do, I'd love to know what your thoughts are on, especially if you're if you're a pastor or if you're in youth ministry or if you're an educator or if you're a counselor, challenge for you. Pick up that book, The Digital Invasion, and read through it. And then maybe get back to me. I'll give you 30 days for this homework assignment if you're in some kind of one of those professions that I mentioned. Why don't you pick up that book if you have time the next 30 days? Read through it. Let me know what you think because I really love to know if you think I'm totally off base here, or if you think I've got this, some of this stuff is really, really troubling. Well, it's 13 minutes past the hour, and coming up next, we're going to be talking to one of my friends from Focus on the Family about an incredible outreach that they have, a program to find homes, forever homes, for orphans and kids in foster care. Stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network.
For Family Talk, here's Dr. James Dobson.
When your children are struggling, are you willing to sacrifice personally to be there for them? Good question. When I was 16 years old, I started flirting with rebellion at home. My dad was a traveling evangelist at the time, and he was gone a lot. And that left my mom alone to deal with my antics. I'll never forget the night we had a major clash. She went to the phone and she called my dad. I was around the corner listening, and I heard her say simply, "I need you." My dad was a very popular minister in those days, and he had a 4-year slate of engagements lined up. It made no difference to him. He immediately canceled his commitments and came home. And a few days later, he did something that shocked me down to my toes. He put a sign in our front yard, and he sold our house. Shortly thereafter, we moved 700 miles away, and Dad became a pastor of a local church. We spent my last 2 years of high school hunting and fishing together and getting in touch again. It was a terrible career move for Dad, and he never fully recovered from it professionally. But it was a sacrifice he and my mom were willing to make. And because of it, they pull me back from the edge. Are you willing to sacrifice when your kids are in need?
There's more Family Talk with Dr. James Dobson at MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And welcome back. Our phone number is 877-93-FAITH. Jot that down because we have a couple of books to give away. Actually, we have three books by a Focus on the Family expert this first half hour and three books by our second guest in the second half hour. So if you call us up, you give us your name, address, phone number, email address, we will put you into that drawing. And at the end of the first half hour, we'll have a book to give away and then the end of the second half hour. So how's that for a deal? Well, my first guest this hour is Katie Overstreet from Focus on the Family. She is the program director for the Adoption and Orphan Care Initiative. Katie works to raise awareness and recruit families for kids who are waiting in foster care, as well as provide post-placement resources for adoptive families. Through Focus's Wait No More conferences, Katie has had the privilege of working with orphan advocates across the country to motivate believers to take action on behalf of orphans and vulnerable children. And Katie, welcome to Faith Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
It's a blessing to have you on the program. And before we talk about Focus's work in this critical area, I'd love for our listeners to get to know you a bit personally. What is your own background and what caused you to be so passionate about this particular issue?
That's a great question. Actually, it's a story that I kind of love to share, but not for the obvious reasons that you may think. So right off the bat, I am not adopted. I am not an adoptive parent or a foster parent or even a parent at all. My siblings weren't adopted. My parents weren't, no cousins. There's no history, if you will, of adoption or foster care within my family. And God really just started opening my eyes and my heart to the needs of kids and orphans and vulnerable children, and specifically the kids who are in our U.S. foster care system. So it started about 8 years ago. I moved to Colorado just because I wanted to live in the mountains. And I said, God, I want to stay here. I'd love if you provided a job. So that's when I started working at Focus. And right at that time, we were launching the Adoption and Orphan Care Initiative. And my previous role at Focus was it allowed me to really interact with this new initiative to try and help decide what are we going to do and how are we going to measure it and what's Focus's role. And through that process, God really just opened my eyes and my heart to the needs of kids right here around us. And gave me what the scripture says, a voice for the voiceless, and gave me a call to speak up for those who cannot speak for themselves. And the reason I said I love sharing that story is because often in this area that when you talk to people who are passionate about topics of orphan care and adoption, you'll often find that they are adoptive parents, which is a beautiful thing, and certainly I support adoption. But I also don't want us to exclude those people who say, you know, God hasn't called me to adopt, so apparently this isn't my issue, or apparently I shouldn't be involved in this. But really what we see is that whether or not you're called to adopt is sort of an irrelevant thing as it relates to what you can do in the life of an orphan or a vulnerable child. And so I feel like God has really used me over these last 8 years to speak truth about his kids in foster care and to help call families towards considering adoption, but also to speak to that other segment of people that say, you know, I don't think adoption is right for us. And I say, great, let's talk about what that means then for you and how you can be involved and how you can support both the cause of adoption, adoptive families, through your church ministry. So I feel like God has kind of given me a unique perspective on this issue, and I'm really grateful for that.
What are some of the numbers, Katie, right now as we look at adoption, foster care in the United States? How many kids do we, and I know maybe these figures are hard to come by, but do we have an approximate number of how many kids, let's say, are completely orphaned and how many kids are sort of languishing in foster care and cannot find a forever home?
Sure. Yeah, you're right. The numbers, we do have access to numbers, but of course they are estimates, or I guess I shouldn't say estimates. They were exactly accurate at least one day in time. But of course the numbers fluctuate on a daily basis. And so there are always kids entering and exiting foster care. So we can't get up to the minute numbers and statistics, but they don't tend to fluctuate too greatly within that certain range. So right now in the United States, there are about 400,000 kids in foster care. Now, what that means is that there has been some allegation of abuse or neglect, and then it's been substantiated, meaning that a caseworker went in to investigate and said, yeah, it's not safe for this child or these children to remain here in this family. So they've taken them from the home and placed them in the care of a foster family. Now, for most of these kids, the goal is reunification, and everybody is trying to get kids reunified with their birth families. We're certainly not out to take people's kids and don't want to disrupt families more than we would need to, but certainly want to keep kids safe in the midst of that. So there's a whole population of kids who are working towards reunification as their birth families are trying to get jobs, trying to find housing, maybe doing anger management or substance abuse classes, so really working to regain custody of their kids. But what's happened for about 100,000 of those kids is that it's been determined by the court that after usually a fairly lengthy period of time, the birth family is not in a position to be able to regain custody. And so in order to serve the best interests of the child, we can't just keep waiting and hoping that the family will be able to regain custody. So that's where the court has to intervene, and they do what's called a termination of parental rights. So when we think about orphans in the United States, it's not quite the same context as we would think about orphans in Africa. You know, Africa is a whole different issue. We've got AIDS and other illnesses that are just eradicating the healthy adults and leaving the elderly and the vulnerable and the orphans and the vulnerable. So what we see here in the States is that the kids' biological families may still be alive, but the reality is that they don't have any legal custody over those kids because of choices that they've made. So we've got about 100,000 kids right now in the United States who we consider legal orphans. And again, these are kids who've had that termination of parental rights. It's been determined that they can't return to birth family. So now their social workers and caseworkers are actively looking for an adoptive family to welcome these kids home.
Hmm. Now, these stats can seem somewhat overwhelming, and yet each one of them represents a personal story. And Katie, I know you're familiar with many of those personal stories because Focus on the Family has been involved in several different cities with your Wait No More campaign. Tell me a story about maybe a child, an older child, who was just languishing in the foster care system and someone felt called to take them in and become their forever family.
Yeah, we do. We are in a fun position to get to see stories like this from around the country. And what we're seeing more and more is what you just mentioned, families who are willing to say, we understand that older teens might be a little more difficult, but we're willing to step out in faith because God has asked us to do it. Just because a child is 12, 14, 16, even 17 and a half, doesn't mean that they don't deserve a family. And so before they age out at age 18, we're seeing families step forward and welcome these kids in, which is such a beautiful thing. There was one family that came to one of our events in Colorado, and they came and they said, the wife was very excited about the idea of adoption. The husband wasn't, but he came and he wanted to listen and he wanted to kind of jump in and at least, you know, be diligent in pursuing and asking questions. But they left the event saying, I'm not quite sure this is the right time. So fast forward a little bit, she decides, well, I'm still going to volunteer. And so she started working with some other organizations, and through the course of her volunteer work, she met a young girl named Amanda. Now, they just formed this kind of friendship, and she would meet consistently with her. So now this has been a couple of years since that first conversation they had about adoption at our Wait No More event. And at this point now, Amanda is turning 17 years old, and as the what's going to be her adoptive mom is hearing more about her case, she's realizing that Amanda's about to age out of foster care. She doesn't have a connection to birth family. She's got some siblings who are also in foster care or who have just aged out of foster care, and she sees that Amanda's on that same path to not have support, to not have people caring for her and looking after her. And so she approached Amanda with the idea. She actually told her, I can't be volunteering in my current capacity and working with you anymore, which really disheartened Amanda. And she said, and that's because we feel like we are to be your new parents. So, you know, you can imagine just the elation that Amanda felt that this woman who she's come to know and respect is now offering to open her home to Amanda and to give her a place to belong. So certainly there hasn't been just not an easy, smooth path. There certainly have been rough patches as they work through different things and understanding that, you know, Amanda has history of her own and has perspectives of her own, but as they're working to say, how does that fit within the context of our family? And they were able to finalize that adoption just a couple weeks before Amanda's 18th birthday, which is huge in the life of a child. For kids who turn 18, they age out of foster care, and honestly, they're not given many support structures. They're not given the kind of help that they need to really transition well into whatever that next phase of life looks like. You know, there are young kids in our Heart Gallery here, which is a collection of portraits of waiting kids, and it's used as a recruitment tool. And there was one guy in particular that I've still never actually met this young man, but when I saw his picture, my heart was drawn towards him. I think part of it was because we shared the same birth month. So it was a clear indicator for me to be praying for him because I knew that in about 10 months he was going to be turning 18. And as I'm praying for him, I'm praying, God, would you just intervene and show this man your love through the love of a family and show him that he's valued and loved and wanted. And then fast forward to now this September was going to be his birthday. So late in September, we're setting up the Heart Gallery for another event, and I pull out his photo. And my heart sank because here was this young man who was, I know because of his birth date, that he had just turned 18. And I was so sad. And right behind me came the caseworker and hung a ribbon right on his photo, and it said, adoption pending. Mm. So for this young man in that month where it seems like, God, why would you have waited so long? And couldn't you have done something sooner? God knew that the right timing for the family to come for this almost 18-year-old young man, that he was going to provide the family that he needed. So those are the kinds of stories that we're seeing. Of course, all ages in between, so many different ways that God is knitting families together. It's really cool to watch.
Mm. Katie, we've just got about 2 minutes left, but tell me how a family who maybe, as you said, doesn't feel called to adopt or take in a foster child can support someone in their church who's doing that exact thing.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. This is an important issue that Focus has really tried to take even on more strongly in the last couple of years, because while we can do what we can on the recruitment side to encourage families and speak truth about adoption from foster care and just make people aware of the need, there's also this need on the back end. And as I mentioned, if you've got kids who are coming into foster care because of abuse and neglect, you can imagine how that's impacted them. And we can only imagine the trauma that does to our brain and the way we have trouble coping maybe with more moves and more challenges in life. And so when we look at these families who are saying, we're going to open our home to a child or to maybe a sibling set, those families need our support and they need our love. And too often I think in the church we've kind of isolated these issues and said, okay, well, we're going to help you recruit families, and we as the church are going to talk about how important adoption is, but we're not necessarily going to be there to understand your unique needs on the backside. So for those families who say, you know, maybe we're not called to adopt or maybe not right now, what can we do? We would love to see you wrap around adoptive families, and we use WRAP as an acronym. So first that would be wrestle in prayer and really lift up the needs of that family. Maybe consider forming a really tight prayer group around one specific family that they know they can trust you to pray for their very unique needs. Then the R stands for respite care, which is simply a form of child care, giving the family a break, whether it's 2 hours to do grocery shopping, 4 hours for dinner and a movie date night, or for a weekend for the parents to be able to get away a little bit. How can you provide some of that respite care that honors the family? Doing acts of service is the A, and serving through bringing meals, through helping with yard work. Maybe it's helping laundry or errands or carpools or whatever those kinds of acts of service may be. Those things help free up the family and the parents to be able to invest more in the lives of their children because they're not so stressed about worrying about how am I going to get dinner cooked or how am I going to get this child picked up from school or how am I going to get all of these other things done in my day. And then lastly, Katie, is the promises of God, so just communicating those to a family. So.
We're about out of time, Katie, but I want to recommend folks go to the Focus on the Family website to learn more, or iCareAboutOrphans.org. Katie Overstreet, thank you so much for your time and for your heart for these wonderful children.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate you having me.
This is the Faith Radio Network. My guest, Katie Overstreet from Focus on the Family. We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Yeah.
encouragement for an active walk of faith. Podcast audio of today's programs on Faith Radio in case you missed the show. The very latest on conferences and events in your area. It's all in one place and delivered right to your inbox from Faith Radio when you subscribe by email to myfaithradio.com. Head to myfaithradio.com and enter your email address in the subscribe box right at the top of the page, helping you connect faith to life every day at myfaithradio.com.
Hey friends, this is Susie Larson, and I'm inviting you to join us for our 40-day challenge, Commit to Live Fit, a journey of faith and fitness as we head into our Easter season. We just finished week one, where we focused on water. Be sure to drink 8 to 10 glasses of water per day and spend time drinking in the water of the Word. You can still sign up for the challenge at myfaithradio.com to receive the weekly email with tips and encouragement. Take the Lenten journey with us at myfaithradio.com/commit to live fit.
Continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And we do want to hear from you, whether you're listening to us here in the Twin Cities or perhaps in Madison or Fargo or Sioux Falls. Maybe you got us on in Waterloo or Duluth. Did I leave anybody else? I don't think so. We would love to hear from you, 877-93-FAITH, and give us your contact info. We'll enter you into a drawing for our a copy of one of these wonderful books, 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn-Out Culture by our guest, Sean Gladding. Sean, in the story, which we mentioned before, this was a sermon series that you did when you were in Houston, but then you turned it into a story, which I love because I think story can teach us so much. It can reach the heart, both the heart and the mind. The pastor refers to the Ten Commandments as the 10 words. Why does he do that, and what difference does it make to the characters?
Yeah, most of us are very familiar with the Ten Commandments. You know, even in America, still, it's not a post-Christian culture like the United Kingdom is. And so even if people don't know what they are, they've still heard of the Ten Commandments. But interestingly enough, if you actually read the Hebrew Bible, only one time in the whole of Scripture are they referred to as the Ten Commandments. Everywhere else, they're referred to as the Ten Words, which is where we get the word Decalogue from, another word for the Ten Commandments. And so even at the beginning of Exodus 20, it says, and God spoke all these words to Moses. And so the reason they're not really commandments in the technical sense is that there is no punishment ascribed for breaking them. If you read the rest of the law, all the other commandments, if you break this commandment, this is what happens to you. But in the 10 words, there's none of that. And so I really wanted to emphasize that reality, and again, realizing that most of us still approach the Ten Commandments as rules and not as words, or as I tend to talk about them, as practices that God gives us to adopt, rather than rules either to keep or not. And so I think thinking about them as rules has not really been helpful for us, especially in this stage of cultural movement in the United States. And so because it's our rules and they become something, I think when we talk about them as rules, what we usually mean is those are rules that those people over there ought to keep. And I think that's why we argue and fight to try and get them posted in public places like courthouses to say, America, we sense it's going in the wrong direction morally. What we need is if we just posted the Ten Commandments in courthouses, then that would be a reminder of the rules by which our society should be governed. And, you know, while I think there is something to that, I think much more helpful and probably more faithful to the scriptures is these are things that God has given to us, those who claim to follow Jesus, as practices to embody ourselves rather than rules to impose on other people. The idea being that if we actually lived according to what the Ten Commandments, the Ten Words, call us to, I think that would be far more compelling than people seeing them carved into stone on a courthouse lawn. And that's always the challenge with Scripture. It's much easier to argue about what the Bible does or doesn't say, or what this means or what it doesn't mean, rather than actually try to embody that in the way we live our life. And I think that our life is what is the most compelling witness to the gospel, and not our ability to talk about what the Bible says or what we think it says. And so I hope in terms of talking about them as the 10 words or 10 practices, especially in the context for which they are given, that that's a helpful way into this really countercultural way of life that the Bible calls us to, and that Jesus embodied and then called us as his disciples to live.
Tell me about some of the characters in the book. Who are they, and what are their backgrounds, and how do they interact with this pastor?
Yeah, so the context is that this pastor, his day off is Mondays, and he's sitting in his favorite coffee shop early in the morning, and one of the characters in the coffee shop that everyone knows and loves starts berating the Christians because of what he sees in the headline of the newspaper that day, which ironically was the actual headline in my local newspaper, the Lexington Herald Leader, on the day I sat down to begin writing the book. And right on the front cover of the paper were these words, 10 commandments fight proves costly. And two counties in eastern Kentucky, the poorest part of our state, had fought for the right to post the 10 commandments in their courthouses all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. And the report said, you know, if you've been following this story, this is the end. And what it's meant is that these counties now owe the ACLU $500,000 in legal fees. And they admit that, frankly, they don't know where the money's going to come from. Mm. And so this character says, what do you think about that, Pastor? What do you think about, you know, you Christians doing stuff like that? So it's very provocative, you know, and questions that I've heard people have asked me. And then the pastor begins to respond, and as often happens, if you're in the kind of coffee shops, at least that I hang out in, other people get involved, drawn into the conversation, share their own opinions. And so the conversation, you know, begins around that, and then that becomes sort of the focal point for a wider discussion about American culture in general and the sort of way we have a sense that we're losing our way. Whatever we think, we recognize that this is not the kind of world, the kind of country we thought we were living in, that there are all kinds of challenges, social challenges we're facing, and politicians don't seem to be helping us address them. And so that then leads into this pastor saying, you know what, this has been really stimulating, and I've been wondering about preaching a sermon series. Maybe I should preach a series on the Ten Commandments, and maybe you guys could help me prepare that each week. Would you be willing to come back every Monday and have a conversation? And so that's sort of how the setting for the book takes place. And so week by week, and that small group and then some other people are added to it, get together for an hour to discuss one of the Ten Commandments each week, which really modeled how I approached the sermon series, which was I got together about 6 months before I planned to preach with a group on Wednesday nights, which was very diverse, and we looked at one of the commandments, we read some other scriptures around it, and then had a discussion. Where does this word intersect with your life? What do you think about this? What are the implications for this? And so some of the other characters that join the conversation are folk from the pastor's church, so they self-identify as Christians. And several of them are in recovery from addiction. And then there's a couple of high school students who join the conversation in, I think, the third week. To bring a more youthful perspective, perhaps. So it's a pretty diverse group, and that's the sort of the group that then has this conversation each week about one of the words.
Who's the character that first confronts the pastor? You said kind of a local character.
Yeah, his name is Steve, and I have known lots of Steves. When you've been a pastor, if any of people listening are in pastoral or self, you know, where people know you as a church employee or a pastor, then if you're in a public setting, you become the expert on the faith, on Christianity, or even any religion sometimes, and people say, hey, what do you think about that, pastor? You're a pastor, you should know. And so I've known several characters like that, and they're lovely, and I thoroughly enjoy people and have friends with folk who still would not consider themselves at all religious, but love talking about matter, you know, things that really matter in life.
I'm curious, so Yeah, I'm curious. How did the pastor respond to this gentleman when he initially confronts him on the Ten Commandments in the courthouse issue? What was his response to this very confrontive gentleman?
Well, it, again, modeled on the way what I have learned over the years is to ask a question rather than get defensive. Which was, and so he says, so why do you think people would be willing to spend $500,000 of taxpayers' money to fight for the right to post those, you know, on court? Can you imagine any reason why people might do that? And so other people begin to give answers to that question. And then says, I wonder if the reason people do that is because not a headline on the front page, but all the headlines inside the newspaper. And so he invites Steve to open the paper and start reading the headlines out. And what do you find in the headlines in the local newspaper pretty much every day? You find talk of theft. You find talk of murder. You find talk of sex scandals of some kind, of politicians lying about other politics. Like, so all the content of the 10 words you can find in the other headlines. And so the pastor says, I wonder if that's why, you know, it's when people read the newspaper or watch the news or just pay attention to what's happening around them, they say, this isn't how we should treat each other. Mm-hmm. And maybe people just want something concrete to point to and say, that is how we ought to treat each other. For better, for worse, at least there's a succinct summary, right, of addressing the things that you and I know are challenges in our neighborhood and in our culture. Mm-hmm. And so that's how he begins to respond.
I love it. I love it. You're reminding me a lot of Tim Keller from Manhattan and his use of questions when he's talking to people who may be hostile to the gospel, maybe skeptics, agnostics. Tim typically uses that same line, and I love it. His book, Reason for God or Reasons for God, mm-hmm, does mm-hmm. that same sort of a thing. In the book, 10, you chose to go through the Ten Commandments in the reverse order. And what was your rationale for that?
Again, I'm borrowing from other folk. My parents still live in England, and many, many years ago, they told me that they'd been a traveling evangelist who had come to our hometown, Norwich, and was doing a series on the Ten Commandments in a very public venue. And not a church, but it's in a public venue. And she's, you know, my parents are saying, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people are coming out every week, and it's not all church folk. And so I was intrigued. I said, well, tell me, why would in England, you know, why would lots of people show up to hear? And she says, that's not just the way he's talking about them. He's very practical. And so I began to research this guy. His name is Jay John. And I read an interview with him, and he said, you know, in a post-Christian culture like the UK, if you want to talk about the Ten Commandments, if you start with the first one, that there is a God, you know, most people aren't going to come back the following week. But if you start with the Tenth Commandment, which is don't want what other people have, well, you know, our economy is based on that. Everyone relates to that. Everyone understands that. So they might come back the next week, and then it's about lying and, you know, not telling the truth and spin. Well, everybody experiences that. And so, you know, people, you hit these last few words, which if you preach them in the reverse order, hit people where they live. And he said, so for some people, if they keep coming back and not only hit them in terms of what other people do, but begin to identify all the ways that they have broken and don't keep these words. If they stick around and get to the first word, which is there is a God who has set you free from slavery, for some people that suddenly becomes good news. Mm-hmm. And it just made total sense to me. And so when it came to preaching the series ourselves at Mercy Street, we did it in that order. And again, in writing the book, I wanted to do it in that order. So that, again, that who doesn't relate to the first few? And then as it gets to the more sort of obtuse, don't have idols, you know, don't bless, you know, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, if you've been working through all these other things, these begin to, you might have a better sense of what these other words might mean.
Great perspective. I love it, Sean. We're talking to Sean Gladding. He is the author of the brand new book, 10 Words of Life for an Addicted, Compulsive, Cynical, Divided, and Worn Out Culture. And we have three copies of the book to give away if you'd like to call us. At 877-93-FAITH, give us your contact info. We'll have a drawing at the end of the hour. And if you have any questions for Sean, by all means, give us a call right now, and we'll pass those along to him. It's 11:45, and you are listening to the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with Sean in just a bit.
In 2014, we're planting truth together on Faith Radio. Here's this week's Bible passage and word from Pastor Andy Stanley.
Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. Did you know your heritage is a pattern of the world? Just because your daddy did it, your great-granddaddy did it, that's just a pattern of the world. Paul says, you don't have to be the same as all of them. Look at the verse. But be transformed. How? By the renewing of your mind, so that you might be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. See, when you start playing those tapes and that old thing comes around, well, I can't help it, I can't change, you stop and you say, no. I am not going to be conformed any longer to the pattern of this world. I'm going to be transformed by the renewing of my mind so that I can test and approve what God's will is, His good, perfect, and perfect will for my life.
Planting truth and growing together this week on Faith Radio. See all the verses and commit them to memory at myfaithradio.com.
It's like my eyes were opened. I kind of knew what I wanted to study, but after discovering what Northwestern had to offer in that field, I finally saw the path.
At Northwestern's Major Discovery, Thursday, March 20th at 5 p.m., your student can learn more about specific majors and take a step closer to deciding what to study in college and where to study it. You can enjoy a nice dinner and visit with professors and students. To register, visit unwsp.edu/visit. University of Northwestern, St. Paul, your life on purpose.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest, Sean Gladding, the author of the new book, 10. Michael Frost, the author of Exile, says, you've never heard the Ten Commandments taught quite like this. And it's true, as Sean has described, it's a pastor in a coffee shop talking to a group of people, and they're actually helping him prepare his sermon series on the Ten Commandments. And let's dive into a few of the commandments. One of the things that you say in the book, I guess the pastor would say it, or maybe it's one of the characters, envy equals desire plus resentment. And I'm wondering, how does that play out in the book? And on a more practical basis, what is the antidote for that in today's materialistic, narcissistic culture?
Again, a great question. That is actually a formula that my best friend and co-pastor at Mercy Street came up with during the series. It's this idea that envy is equal to desire plus resentment. It's not just that I want something, it's that I resent the fact that someone else has it. And that's a key component of envy. It's the old story of trying to keep up with the Joneses, right? It's not enough for me to have what I have. If my neighbor has something better, then I need to have it so I can keep up with them. So there's this resentment. So instead of finding delight that other people have certain things, we've learned to resent them for having them and try and either get them ourselves or perhaps even tear down what they have. And so I think that in some ways, the cynical part of our culture, that our advertising is based on creating desire for things we didn't even know we knew, that we didn't know we needed until we're bombarded with messages that say things like, you deserve this, you need this, it's your right to have this, or that some of the language, especially you deserve, that's a very much the language of advertising in my experience. And so I think one of the antidotes for envy or this sense of, I deserve this, whatever this is gratitude, is learning to be thankful for what we already have. A good friend of mine who's an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous often says, Sean, if you woke up tomorrow morning and the only possessions you had and the only relationships you had left were those that you had been grateful for today, what kind of a home would you wake up to? Yeah. And I think so often we're bombarded with messages that tell us what we lack, what we don't have, that we fail to be grateful for what we have. And so that what I think the word against envy invites us into is a life of contentment, to be satisfied with what we already have. And once we begin to learn that, I think it begins to change fundamentally how we approach possessions and how we approach our neighbors. So instead of being jealous for my friend who just got a brand new Harley Davidson and I'm still riding the same one I've been riding for 22 years, I can celebrate for him and not feel like, well, I need to get one. Why don't I have that? Why hasn't my life worked out? I'm like, you know what? I have a Harley Davidson. And yes, it's 30-something years old, but it still runs. It's a great bike. And I need that reminder. And so I think contentment and gratitude is the antidote to envy and desire plus resentment.
Mm. You know, we're trying in our home to work on that very issue with our children. I have three kids who are 11, 9, and 7, and wonderful children, but there is a lot of envy going on. He got this, she got this, and right now it's over kind of silly things, one of which is play dates. Well, he got more play dates with his friends than I got, and we're trying to help them to learn to be content. And to learn, as you said, to celebrate when their sibling, you know, gets something positive, wonderful, time with a friend is something that, you know, you should celebrate for him instead of saying, I didn't get as many. And it is a real challenge. And I was talking to my wife the other day, and I said, this is just driving me crazy, this envy between these three kids who have so much, so many blessings. And I try to remind them, you know, we sponsor two kids through Compassion, and I try to remind them, well, you know, Jose in down there in Peru, he ain't going to be going out for frozen yogurt. I mean, he and yet,
right.
So I'm kind of going up against this brick wall with them, and my wife brought me back to earth and said, hun, it's the sin nature. And I went, well, yeah, I guess that's true. Hopefully we'll outgrow it.
It's also developmental, right, at that age.
Yes.
But it's just part of it. And so all we can do is keep enforcing. You know, and I have a 10 and an 8-year-old, so this is not something I'm unfamiliar with. But we just keep reminding them, well, what was good? What was good? What do you have? And hopefully in that just constant repetition, some of that will slowly sink in. But clearly, most of us continue to still struggle with that. So it's a lifelong challenge. But again, it's one that because we forget, we need to be reminded. And so that's why I think God tells Moses, and Moses says, you know, write these on your heart, write them on your forehead, you know, get them into your kids. When you're walking on the road, talk about them, like, because we're so quick to forget these very basic things about what it means to live in community with others where we want the best for each other. So we create the kind of society where everyone can flourish, not just a few.
Another issue you tackle in the book, one of the commandments, which, of course, this is so significant given our sex-saturated culture, is thou shalt not commit adultery. And we have so many in our society who see a commandment, a rule like that, as being unrealistic and incredibly restrictive and narrow-minded. Can you explain, and how your character explains in the book, how it actually brings freedom to our lives?
Yeah, again, this is one perspective, but I think there's a great deal of truth in this, in that it's not, you know, the problem is not that our culture thinks about sex and talks about sex so much. I think the problem is that our culture talks about sex so poorly. And it just reflects our ongoing, highly individualistic culture, which sex is about my self-satisfaction, my need to be fulfilled, and it's very much an emphasis on my rights to have the kind of sex life I think I ought to have. And I think that, again, runs completely counter to the revelation of God and humanity in the scriptures, which is, no, it's not about you and your personal satisfaction. It really is about being part of a people who are seeking the welfare of everybody. And so how do you learn in every area of your life to be self-giving, not self-satisfying? And so I think it's no different in the area of sex than any other area, including one you've just talked about, material possessions. How do I, you know, learn to not try to satisfy my, all of my desires, but how do I want, you know, for people to have what they need to have? And so when it comes to sexuality, I think, yes, you can say, do not commit adultery. Well, what if, you know, what if my spouse can't meet my needs? You know, well, that's one thing to recognize, is that's legitimate. You know, all of us have legitimate needs, and one of those is sexuality, you know, a legitimate need to have a sexual expression that is healthy and life-giving and meaningful. And what do you do if your spouse doesn't meet the need that you have? I'm not sure the best answer is to go find someone else, because often it's not only the, you know, the issue isn't often the only, the other person in the equation. There's often something inside ourselves that's part of that. Also, I think our culture has entirely unrealistic expectations about what sexual satisfaction is. And so, again, returning to the very core, the very beginning of our story, this beautiful description of the first human couple who were naked and unashamed, that I think very, very few of us in this culture ever feel unashamed when we're naked, whether that's naked physically or naked emotionally or naked spiritually. We feel a lot of shame around that. And so how do you learn to become unashamed about your sexuality? How do you learn to become unashamed about your physicality? It's by having a safe place to get naked with someone else. And I truly believe the safest place in the world for the sexual relationship and the safest place in the world to make yourself vulnerable with another human being is in a covenanted relationship where you have made commitments and promises to each other, for better or for worse, in every area of our life. I'm not going anywhere. And so if our sex life is not what we might want, we're not going to go anywhere. We're going to say, how can we figure this out? How do we get help with this? And that is the work of years. It's and sometimes the church has told the equal and opposite untruth, which is if you just save yourself from marriage, then your sex life will be great. I think that's not true. As anyone who has done that has probably realized, you know, marriage is hard work. You know, beautiful shared sexuality is hard work. None of this is easy. But the key is to have a safe container within which to work that out. And I really believe covenanted relationships are the safest place for that to happen. And so what we find is that if you go looking for that somewhere else, you may find it briefly. As many people do. But then if you break up one marriage and move into the other one, then all the things that you brought to your own first marriage that you know, were part of the problem, you bring right into the second one. So the challenge, and we do the same with the church, right? We, you know, well, my needs aren't being met in this church, so I'm going to go find another church.
Exactly.
We do the same thing rather than say, what do I have to bring to this? I'm sorry, we're
just about out of time for the hour, and
okay.
I'm sorry we've only had a chance to unpack a few of the commandments, but I want to encourage our listeners to get this book, Sean Gladding's 10, and you will find the 10 commandments will come alive in a brand new way. Thank you for your time today, Sean, your commitment to biblical truth, and we appreciate you so much.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me on your show, Bill.